You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
George Herrmann's comic strip Crazy Cat, which ran from 1913 to 1944, is considered one of the greatest of the 20th century, inspiring a generation of cartoonists ranging from Charles Schulz to Bill Watterson, as well as poets and writers like E.E. Cummings and Jack Kerouac. Yet in 1971, a detail emerged about Herrmann that would have ruined him if he were still alive and working. His birth certificate labeled him as colored, revealing that he'd spent his entire adult life passing as white. Michael Tisserand investigated Herrmann's complicated family history and reveals how much he was able to inject his feelings about race and racism into his Crazy Cat strips, despite barely anyone noticing. His latest book, Crazy, George Herrmann, A Life in Black and White, is published by Harper. I'm very pleased that it's brought him to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here talking about George Herrmann.
He was from New Orleans. You are as well. Your last book was about Zydeco, something very different. But did you feel any special connection to him or to Crazy Cat before you began researching the book?
I always loved old comics. When I was a kid, I would spend hours at the 741.59 section of the library where the old Bill Blackbeard anthology of Smithsonian Comics and those other books were. So I loved comics, but it wasn't until it was about a year after Hurricane Katrina, I was up in Chicago, and I took my son, he's 6'3" now, but he was in my arms at the time, to a exhibit called Masters of American Comics at the Milwaukee Art Museum. And the second room was all Herrmann originals. And at that time, I sort of felt an urgency to write about New Orleans history. And walking around and reading those Crazy Cat comics aloud to him made me feel very strongly that I wanted to explore this guy's story.
Well, Herrmann was from New Orleans, as we said, but he grew up in Los Angeles. Do we see New Orleans reflected? The New Orleans culture reflected in the strips in any way?
Not in any real overt way. There's his large extended family include Jelly Roll Morton, and there's actually a little Jelly Roll Morton reference in one comic about these waltzing mice that they're upset because their children were jazz mice and they were dancing and singing Jelly Roll Morton. But I think it's more in the strip, in the way he deals with color and identity. In a very layered way, the way that the racial society of New Orleans in the 19th century that he came from was a very multi-layered society.
Would people have spotted it, at least some really sophisticated people?
Well, Stanley Crouch said that he talked to Ralph Ellison, who was surprised to find out that George Herrmann was black or was African-American.
And well, he's mixed race, but
mixed
very
race.
Light skin, passed enough to pass for white. He used to wear a hat so that you wouldn't see his hair.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk black, African-American, mixed race, we're really in Herrmann territory because one of his great themes was that language just doesn't shoulder the burden of talking about identity the way we try to make it shoulder that burden. You know, he had this one comic strip where Crazy, and we're jumping ahead perhaps to Crazy
Cat
strip.
No, it's okay. We'll go back.
I tend to think in Crazy Cat strips these days. There's this one strip where Crazy Cat's working in a diner, and Ignatz the mouse orders coffee and sends it back and says, "I want a black coffee." And Crazy Cat says, "That is black coffee. You got to look under the milk."
Ooh.
And that's how Herrmann approached this topic in this really sort of strange, transformative way that really challenges the whole idea of the way we try to, even now in 2016, talk about race.
Well, what about the challenge for you? Is it difficult to research 19th century genealogy in New Orleans? How far back could you trace Herrmann's family line?
I now know Herrmann's family better than my own. I was fortunate that I was able to move back to New Orleans to do this project. I thought I was going to be writing it from Chicago. And, you know, Herrmann was a man of the world, and he went back and forth between New York and California, never went back to New Orleans. But once I was in New Orleans, I was able to spend many afternoons in the City Hall notarial archives and look at the records of land purchase, and especially the Archdiocese, the Catholic Church archives. And that kind of told the tale. The baptisms and weddings of the Herrmann family traced back ancestors. I was able to find Stephen Herrmann, the White Riverboat pilot from New York, his great-grandfather, and the time that he was with Justine Olivier, a free woman of color, just long enough to have two kids, one of them Harriman's grandfather.
But slavery was still in effect at that time.
It was, and there was actually there was slave ownership within Harriman's family itself. It's a complicated, difficult subject, New Orleans, 19th century, and it's not it's as complicated and not easy as a Crazy Cat comic.
Complicating the story is that there's a whole bunch of George Harrimans here. His grandfather was named George. What did he do for a living?
His grandfather was a tailor, and his father was a tailor. There was a Harriman and Son tailor shop on Royal Street in
were
the French Quarter.
Were they seen, thought of as African-Americans?
They were Creoles of color. They were seen as mulatto or colored or Creole. One thing that as I started to learn more about this family in 19th century New Orleans, even more than the complexity of their color in society in New Orleans at that time was the fierce political activity that they were engaged in. Both Harriman's father and grandfather signed onto a petition that a family friend hand-delivered to Abraham Lincoln for voting rights. They were part of a Creole seance movement when they would get together and be visited by Benjamin Franklin or Jesus Christ, who would encourage them during this really difficult time to keep going forward, that there will be, you know, the light is ahead and they will enter a new society and create a new society. So when the Harriman family in 1890 decided to leave that world.
And 1890.
1890, yes. Yeah. I jumped ahead a little too quickly. In 1890, when the Harriman family decided to leave that world for Los Angeles and pass as white, I can't imagine, you know, not just leaving the color behind, but leaving behind that rich, complicated, and very active society.
So that was their intention, going to Los Angeles, which was at that time a pretty much pioneer territory, that they could pass for white?
Yeah.
And transform their identities there?
Yeah, and it's such a difficult thing to talk about in some ways. It's such an, you know, hopefully antiquated and growing even more antiquated term, passing as white. You know, in my life, there's sort of sexual preference passing that I knew. Growing up, I knew people who had to pass as straight. You know, in my children's life, hopefully that will seem as antiquated to them. But at that time, they did make that decision to identify as white people in Los Angeles. And I think my sense of it is when schools started to close to their kids, that's when they made the decision. Because as soon as they got to Los Angeles, both George Harriman and his brother were enrolled in this wonderful school called St. Vincent's College. And it was a Vincentian school, which a Jesuit priest told me was as good as a Jesuit school, but without the publicity. So it was a very, very strict, very demanding classical education that Harriman enjoyed from that time on as a white student.
My guest is Michael Tisserand, who is the author of a number of books, The Kingdom of Zydeco, which won the ASCAP Deems Taylor Award for Music Writing. He also wrote a Hurricane Katrina memoir, Sugar Cane Academy, and now Crazy, which is the George Harriman story, A Life in Black and White. How did he become interested in cartooning? And was Crazy Cat what he conceived of at the beginning, or was he doing other stuff first?
He was working as an office boy at the Los Angeles Herald when he was 16 years old, cleaning up the chalk dust from chalk plate, which is an old technology of cartooning at the time. You'd scratch into a plate and then pour the metal over it. And they started running political cartoons, the political convention as the office boy saw it, and he would start to do comics that ran in the classified section, these little, you know, in fact, his first black cat was during that time, this little tiny black cat at somebody's side while he was reading the want ads. He ended up coming here to New York at age 19 and was living in a boarding house on Coney Island. And he was here right during the newspaper war between Joseph Pulitzer and William Hearst, a war waged with comics in many ways.
And he worked for both of them.
He worked for both of them. He went to Hearst first, got fired there, was told he just didn't have the spark and to give it up. Went over to Pulitzer, did some comics there, and ended up coming back to Hearst and stayed with Hearst.
And that's when he developed Crazy Cat?
It wasn't until he was drawing little black. He was very, you know, comics are kind of historically a marginalized art, and Harriman's kind of been marginalized in the history of comics. And Crazy Cat kind of grew literally out of the margins. He would start to draw these little cats and these little dogs, whether in sports comics or in comic strips, having little conversations. There was one boxing comic about the racial line in boxing. the color line in boxing between white boxers and black
boxers.
That's
because of the Jack Johnson, James J. Jeffries fight, which Jack London unfortunately coined the phrase the Great White Hope.
Exactly. And Herrmann did comic after comic about that boxing color line. Sam Langford and Joe Gans and Jack Johnson, all these superior black boxers. And he started to draw boxers as black cats. And you first see that crazy cat face on the face of actually the Sam Langford boxing comics. And then he came to New York and was trying to find a strip, did a strip called The Dingbat Family. And it was right after that Johnson-Jeffries fight that he put a little white mouse with the black cat, and they started battling out with the white mouse, throwing a little pebble at first, and then it was a champagne glass, and sooner or later became a brick, and it stayed a brick.
And the cat winds up being the victim all the time. He gets hit in the head. It's almost slightly masochistic.
Well, it's absolutely
masochistic. Is that a comment on race in America at the time?
I tend not to see Harriman's work as a grand allegory. I more think that Herrmann brought everything he had into the strip. And this relationship between the white mouse and the black cat was certainly part of that.
Now, the spirit is almost Dadaist. Was he sophisticated enough?
Absolutely.
Was he aware of what was going on in the world of art?
I met a woman, Hal Roach's niece, who knew Herrmann and said he always carried a book with him at all times. He was part of a group called the Penguins that brought in a Vortices show in the late 19-teens here in New York. He was good friends with the person who developed the Armory show here. His friends Rudy Dirks, who did the Cast and Jammer Kids, had paintings in the Armory show. Herrmann is very well aware of what he was doing, and I think very conscious of those trends in art as well. And I think when he started doing comics, especially in the late teens, that were frustrating readers because they did go back and forth about language. He did one comic where Crazy Cat and Ignatz the mouse were debating whether or not language is so we can understand each other or language so that we can misunderstand each other. I think it was an intellectual question for Herrmann, and I think also, given his situation as a person passing in society, it was one that struck really deeply for him also.
It's also gender bending.
He was.
We're not sure whether Crazy Cat is male or female.
Or both or neither. Herrmann did a Crazy Cat strip in which Crazy Cat talked about going to register to vote. Women got the vote, and Crazy Cat went to go register to vote and was asked male or female and didn't want to offend anybody, so said both. And when I think about that, I often think about Herrmann in 1900 when he had to fill out the census when he was in that boarding house on Coney Island and had to choose a race and must have had a sort of similar experience. Frank Capra, the director of It's a Wonderful Life, asked Herrmann. Readers hated this fact that Crazy Cat was both male and female. It's very confusing to read. They complained. They asked the newspaper to drop the strip. And Capra asked about this. And Herrmann said, who was a student of Shakespeare, said that he liked to make Crazy Cat a sprite, sort of like Ariel in The Tempest, I think, a sprite that was free to butt into anything. And any cartoon adaptations of Crazy Cat always fail once Crazy Cat opens the mouth and there's a sort of a little girl voice there. And in the book, I worked very hard. There are no pronouns referring to Crazy Cat.
Because male or female, he or she.
Male or female. So, yeah, Crazy Cat is a great gender-fluid cat.
Well, you mentioned that readers often ask for it to be dropped. By the time I saw Crazy Cat, it was a cult favorite, considered one of the greatest strips in the history of the 20th century. Did some people react to it that way then, or was it always kind of marginal?
Absolutely. It was. It seemed to have had this real following in Harvard. When E. Cummings went at Harvard, he papered his dorm wall with Crazy Cat comics. And Gilbert Seldes went on to champion Herrmann in the pages of Esquire and there in Vanity Fair. Edmund Wilson was a fan. And right after Harriman's death in 1944, E. Cummings wrote to his publisher and said, I want to put out an anthology of Crazy Cat comics. I don't want this guy to be lost to history. And when you read the early E.E. Cummings letters to Gilbert Seldes and to others about Crazy Cat, you see E. Cummings kind of taking on Crazy Cat's voice. Crazy Cat speaks in this really strange blending of Yiddish and French and German and newspaper slang and Elizabethan English. And you see E.E. Cummings, and it's hard to quite see where that ended and E.E. Cummings' own poetic voice began. It just sort of seems to trail into that direction. And that was the That was the book that led to a greater appreciation of Crazy Cat. Charles Schulz saw that book when he came home from the war, and others.
Why did he retire? Why did Harriman retire?
He died drawing the strip.
Oh, it did?
Yeah, he grew more and more sick in the late 1930s and early 1940s. He suffered from migraines. He had arthritis. There were jokes, even when he was about 30 years old, he was making jokes about having rheumatism. And, you know, I don't want to say that he was depressed, you know, in a diagnostic fashion, but there are letters from friends and people talking about trying to get him to come out of his house. He was in a beautiful house at the end of a winding road in the Hollywood Hills at that time, and continued to draw this really lovely, joyful strip, but was going through hard times. He had lost a lot of people in his life by then.
In her review in the Wall Street Journal, Sarah Boxer wrote that women are practically non-existent in this biography, and that Harriman was in fact surrounded by unhappy women. And he spent his life trying to escape them. Is that fair criticism?
I don't understand where she gets that interpretation from, actually. There's very little information about Harriman and his wife available. Very little I could track down. No letters between them. The only moment I found Harriman writing was after his wife died in a tragic car accident. He was planning a surprise party for his daughter and sent a letter to his friends in Arizona and said, Kitty was his nickname for his wife, and said, this is Kitty's idea. She talks to me. And this was after his wife had died. So I felt the love and the loss and the grief at that moment. It is true that it was a man's world in the New York art departments at Hearst and Pulitzer. Nell Brinkley was probably the exception to that rule, this great woman cartoonist that really didn't have much interaction with George Harriman that I found. But later in his life, I'm not quite sure why Sarah actually wrote that, because there were some amazing pioneering women that were very close to Harriman. Louisa Wetherill, who translated the life of a Navajo medicine man and wrote about the Navajo and spoke their language and was quite an Arizona pioneering, very close friend to Harriman. And then in the last years of his life, there was a woman named Louise Cher Swinnerton, who was actually divorced from Jimmy Swinnerton, Harriman's best friend, and was a pioneering journalist very early in her life. And they shared a love of the desert, the Monument Valley, the place where Harriman set Crazy Cat. And I was able, happily, to find a lot of correspondence between them and talk with her grandson, and was able to talk about that relationship in great detail.
Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White is published by Harper. My great thanks to Michael Tisserand for coming by to talk about it.
It's great to be here, and I love bringing people to Crazy Cat. After 10 years of research, I never get tired, and I'm still seeing new things in his strips.